Hi everyone, we are back and we are backtracking a bit today, but it's necessary, I swear.
I think you're right, and it is a perfect segue into our next episode about Operation Lobster.
I didn't even think about that. Okay, before we get started, I have two things. First, thanks to everyone who responded to my music question and our no-nonsense approach. Bare Bones won out unanimously.
Yeah, we both loathe all that fluff when we were listening to a podcast, so I'm happy.
Me too, and it's less work for me also. And the second thing is we have to answer one question from our listeners.
Well, David would like to know, was Gerard Wimette behind the hit on George Besmajian?
That is a tough one. I really don't know how much Wimette was involved with the drug smuggling. I always think of him more of a good thief than a drug dealer. But hopefully some of our listeners can share their knowledge about Wimette and what he was actually up to. So although from a hierarchy standpoint, it makes sense that Tillinghast would have sought Wimette's approval, I suspect they may have been acting independently from that structure, kicking up a piece of their profits from the weed smuggling to whoever necessary, but they were likely taking care of their own personal problems, I think.
Well, I think that you're probably correct. Okay, let's move on to our loan sharks in Massachusetts. We briefly mentioned Skinny Cazzone's loan sharking case in the last episode, so let's start off there because the timing of his sentencing and Jimmy Modorano's arrest on loan sharking charges were just days apart. On September 18, 1975, the authorities claimed that with the conviction of Cazzone on two counts of loan sharking and the efforts of, quote, the federal crime fighters, unquote, not my terminology, they had broken organized crime's illegal lending operations.
Well, they obviously forgot about a couple of those pesky sharks because on September 26th, just 8 days later, 11 men were hit with an assortment of charges related to loan sharking activities. The indictments had remained a secret until that day.
Well, do you think they held back the indictments until they had the Cazzone's case wrapped up?
I would say so. They were selling Cazzone as the jaws of loan sharking and that by taking him off the streets, they were dealing a deadly blow to the mob. They couldn't make that sale if they had other guys in the pipeline, let alone 11 of them.
That's for sure.
So those arrested were Anthony Tony Blue D'Agostino, Richard Vinny the Pig DeVincent, Marino Mario Lepore, Edward Maiani, James Modorano, Pasquale Fuzzy Romano, Joseph Joe the Barber Spaziani, Robert Visconti, and Frank Pagano. Plus our two jailbirds, James Matera and Edward Brian Halloran, who would meet his end in 1982 at the hands of his partners in crime, along with Mikey Donahue, whose only mistake was to offer Brian a ride.
Matera and Halloran were already in jail thanks to an argument that they had had with an off-duty cop because Matera was double parked on the waterfront. The incident had occurred in March of 74. A three-on-one brawl ensued, and the cop was beaten, but he managed to shoot one of his attackers, Louis Belmonte, a bartender at Chandler's.
And you just had to get Chandler's in there.
Hey, it's not like I wrote the story. I'm just telling it. All three men were convicted in May of 75 on charges of assault and battery. John Callahan, who would also meet his end at the hands of the same men as Halloran, had been with the perpetrators just before the brawl and was called as a defense witness. At the trial, Callahan told the court that he had seen Halloran socially at his Commercial Wharf office about half a dozen times since the brawl.
Remember that DeVincent and Lepore had been tried for the murder of Rocco DiSiglio along with Bernard Zinna back in 1966.
Well, along with Jerry Angiulo, and Barboza testified against them, but I still think he killed DiSiglio himself, personally.
And the sociopath cried on the stand.
Talk about drama. As for DeVincent, he would meet a similar end to Halloran and Callahan in 96, and Matera wound up being murdered in 79, so we'll be covering his murder in a few weeks.
A couple of the accused loan sharks managed to escape similar fates. Anthony Tony Blue D'Agostino, former bodyguard of the Winter Hill Gang's founding boss, Buddy McClain, died on February 19, 2010 from natural causes. His biggest case after the loan sharking pinch was for drunk driving in 1988, and he took that thing all the way to appeal and beat it in 1995. There were all sorts of other complaints and domestic issues at his 15 Lorraine Road house that he lived in with his son Anthony Jr., including one incident when Tony Blue was already 70 and Jr. evidently tried to stab him. The home was seized in 2009 for unpaid property taxes totaling over $5,000. The house was auctioned off, and in 2012, revolvers, a rifle, and ammo were found in the ceiling while the house was being renovated. I don't think they were ever able to match any of those to any crimes, though.
So weird. Well, anyway, Frank Pagano still seems to be kicking as far as I can tell. Romano died suddenly in March of 87 of unknown causes. Joe the Barber Spaziano passed away in 2022. But why do you think he was called Joe the Barber?
Probably because he was a barber. Some of the nicknames were just obvious, like what they did, you know? Bobby Visconti would face further charges in 1979, along with DeVincent and one of your faves, Charles Tastian.
Hey, there were more than 40 men charged in that case.
Well, we'll come back to that in a little bit. As for Jimmy Mutterano, we covered his 1966 conviction for being an accessory after the fact in Margaret Sylvester's murder in the hit Parade of 1965. So folks can check that out if they want to hear more about that story.
That case really was insane, and that episode that we did on the 65 hit parade was really good. So definitely check it out, and the link will be in the show notes for sure.
Okay, and I will say yes to both of those things. Halloran and Jimmy had also been arrested on weapons charges on April 8th of 1975. The new gun laws in Massachusetts had come into effect, and people were getting scooped up left and right, both law-abiding citizens and otherwise. And I remember the rumblings about getting a year in the can for being in possession of an unlicensed handgun, and supposedly a year for every bullet. And I don't know how much truth there is to the bullet thing.
Well, now I'm going to have to look.
You can let us know in the next episode.
Okay. Besides Jimmy's legal troubles, he also had ongoing issues with Chandler's. From the beginning, Howie Winter and Jimmy's role in the restaurant was a constant source of curiosity and heat. The authorities had them and the restaurant under surveillance and had searched it for a gun used in one of the many gangland slayings. And we'll just have to do a blog post about Chandler's instead of going into all the nitty-gritty details here.
I agree. Now let's get into the case against our 11 loan sharks. Thanks to a wiretap, multiple phone conversations between Peter Pallotta and several of the defendants revealed that Pallotta borrowed $5,000 in order to open a nightclub in Revere. And of course, Pallotta fell behind in his payments. Then in November of 1974, a masked gunman robbed the club as a warning. So he decided to go to the law and tell all.
And not just any old cop. He allegedly called the U.S. Attorney's Office, who in turn put him in touch with the OC Task Force of New England. Pallotta reportedly told them, "What will I do? I'm scared. I'm afraid they're going to kill me." And like magic, within half an hour, he was sitting with the feds. Pallotta told them that he had also borrowed $2,000 from Jimmy Mutterano, followed by $700 from DeVincent to keep the Revere Beach nightclub, The Bitter End, open. But he couldn't repay the $28 a week at the 156% interest rate that DeVincent was charging him, and DeVincent threatened to break his legs and kill him.
By the end of Pallotta's interview with the feds, he gave them permission to bug his phone. Once the evidence was collected and the indictments returned, Pallotta was given a new identity, Peter Rocco, and shipped off to Orlando, Florida, where he lived until he passed in 1992.
But he still had to testify in open court against Mutterano, DeVincent, and his former cellmate at Lewisburg, Brian Halloran.
What was Pallotta in Lewisburg for?
Well, he was convicted of robbing a bank in Durham, New Hampshire in June of 67. Halloran had also robbed a bank, but in California in December of 1969. He had been arrested almost immediately and convicted the following year, and he was the only one of his crew who got pinched for that, by the way.
I'm sorry, but I don't think Halloran was the sharpest knife in the drawer. The trial came to an end in June, with Jimmy Mutterano being convicted and sentenced to 10 years in Norfolk the following month.
And to bring us back around to the race-fixing case, that's why he was locked up when those indictments were handed down. And he was also doing time for the handgun charges, which had earned him a Walpole sentence. But Walpole was so overcrowded that they shipped him off to the camp-style jail in Lawrence. Halloran was found innocent, but as we mentioned a little while ago, he was already serving a sentence at Norfolk on the previous A and B charges against the off-duty cop.
Visconti and DeVincent were convicted back in April and sentenced to 8 years in May, but were freed on bail pending an appeal. Later that year in November, Phil Wagenheim came up for parole. He had been sentenced in 71 to 12 years in prison for stock fraud, of all things. The parole board blocked his application because of his association with Jimmy and Johnny Mutarano, Howie Winter, George Kaufman, Johnny Cincotti, J.R. Russo, Mike Angiulo, Sammy Granito, Larry Bioni, Joe Battari, and Slim Cazones, to name a few.
You? Who was left?
There was plenty. The following May, Special Agent Dennis Denny, as Joe Barboza liked to call him, Condon, finally retired from the FBI. Then in August, Ted Harrington began serving as the U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts.
And just to get your goat, I've got to mention Chandler's again.
Of course you do.
So in December of 77, Chandler's license was finally revoked by the board. Albert Sakey, attorney of Vincent Salmonte, represented Carol Mutarano at the hearing. The liquor license had been in her name and Howie's daughter's name. And Carol was Jimmy's ex-wife by this point, by the way. So that's...
Gotcha. Okay. With nothing to be done about Chandler's, Jimmy focused his attention on getting a new trial. In February of 78, he filed an appeal on the grounds that attorneys Oteri and Weinberg represented both him and Halloran at trial, and Jimmy had taken the stand in his own defense while Halloran had not. So in his claim, he said that his counsel had divided loyalties.
But here's the kicker. Part of Jimmy's appeal alleged that Zip Connolly had lied to the court once again. As we said before, Pallotta had worn a wire so the FBI could listen in during his interactions with his extortionists. Connolly claimed that a tape recording had been made, but the quality was too poor to present to the court and therefore had been destroyed. Mutarano's motion stated that the recording had not, in fact, been destroyed.
That's like the wiretaps of the Coin-O-Matic, except they stated that they kept recording over them and over them, and that the 302s, as we know, are just summaries and not verbatim records of what was heard or statements that were given.
So. Well, none of that helped Jimmy, and the court rejected his appeal. The following month, two Medford cops were in hot water for writing letters of recommendation for one of Jimmy's co-defendants, Bobby Visconti. They described him as an upstanding citizen for his sentence reduction hearing, which, surprise, surprise, was denied.
The boys were striking out left and right. Then in May, Jimmy's request for a work furlough was also denied. He appealed, saying it was his constitutional right, but good old Judge Roger Donahue, who was also his trial judge, told him, no way. The following month, Jimmy was in the papers again, but this time because of Jack Kelly's slaying at the Black Friars and Kelly's connection to organized crime figures, including both Mutarano brothers.
Well, Jimmy might have been locked away, but it still wasn't safe to go in the water.
I was waiting for you to run with that title of the episode.
Needed the right opening. Folks might remember that the authorities were after Larry Zanino in the fall of 78. Thanks to one of the wiretaps, the feds obtained a search warrant for the laundromat on Chalmette Ave in Boston that they said was the headquarters of a major loan sharking operation. But Larry slipped through their fingers and they snatched up two others instead.
Richard Red Assad, Red Acid, and Dominic Isabella. You can hear more about Isabella, including how he ended up being the first person Dad handed to the feds in episode 26 of this season. The arrests never resulted in any charges being brought against the alleged loan sharks, but in 1980, Red would be scooped up along with Zanino, A.B. Sarkis, and 50 others in a major gambling ring bust.
A week after Red and Isabella's arrests, Jimmy Mutarano's request for a new trial was rejected by Judge Caffrey. In January of 79, Special Agents Connolly and Morris informed U.S. Attorney Jeremiah O'Sullivan that Whitey and Stevie Flemmy were FBI informants, making it official, so to speak. The following month, Johnny Mutarano went on the lam after Whitey and Stevie warned him of the coming indictment.
And that same month, our other two alleged loan sharks, DeVincent and Visconti, who by then had lost their appeals and were locked up, and Charles Tastian, as we mentioned before, were indicted on 41 counts of bankruptcy fraud, mail fraud, and a variety of other charges, along with 17 other men, including Joey Masiello, Frankie Celesti, and Joe Ritchie. All friends of my father and all part of my childhood.
So did Ritchie have anything to do with that case, do you think?
Well, here's the thing. You know, we have all these thews and we have, you know, other, you know, things from other agencies. And there's no mention of that case. And, you know, Dad continued being friends with, you know, all of those guys. So I don't know. It's very strange to me that, you know, three guys that he's close to all get pinched at the same time, and it's a federal thing, and that he didn't have anything to do with it. I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that.
Hmm. Well, but Masiello was wrapped up with Richie with the Plymouth Mail robbery story, right?
Yeah, and that was before Dad met Ernest Tidyman. And you remember Joey Masiello was putting ads in the newspapers trying to get people to give him material for stories. But I don't know. We're going to have to do a bonus episode about all of this sometime between now and the end of the season, because it's definitely an episode in itself. And since it pertains so much to Dad, we have to do some more digging.
Definitely. Now, in a prelude to our next episode, on March 15th, 1979, Operation Lobster was made public when over 40 people were arraigned. The operation was cut short after Special Agent Connolly claimed that Special Agent Jan Turco, who was undercover, was in danger, which allowed Whitey Bulger and Stevie Flemmy to walk free magically.
Oh, magic always, and I'm going to save my comments for the next episode, but let's wrap up our sharks. As we mentioned in the last episode, Jimmy Mutterano was convicted on the race-fixing charges in July of 1979. In January of 1980, he was, after all of the wrangling, granted a new hearing on his loan-sharking conviction, but that proved to be a fruitless endeavor also.
Well, there will be much more to come about these men and more before we wrap up this season between Christmas and New Year's.
This was a real short one today.
Well, we'll definitely make up for it next time because I've got lots and lots of fun goodies that I'm collecting.
Oh, I'm sure you are. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Bye.
Bye.